Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, indeed, it is the Boomer and the Babe Show here on Blog Talk Radio. And as the announcer voice said, the suspiciously familiar announcer voice said, we are coming to you live from our studios in Youngtown, Arizona, also the home of Feeding Arizona and the Valley View Community Food Bank. It is Monday, October 24th, 2011, and I just want to let you know about a few things that are of interest, I hope, to you and everyone else that may be out there. The Valley View Community Food Bank, as I've said before, is a completely free food bank. In other words, nobody pays any money for any food that Valley View Community Food Bank gives out. Now, it's not too soon to start thinking about Thanksgiving, and the Valley View Community Food Bank has an annual huge, absolutely huge turkey dinner that they do, and they are already starting to look for donations of cash and donations of turkeys. And they will gladly take any of your donations with regard to any kind of food. But right now they're starting to have an emphasis on turkeys and cash to buy more turkeys. And you can get hold of them by visiting the Valley View Community Food Bank.com, or you can Google Valley View Community Food Bank, and you'll be able to have your contacts through those auspices. That's number one. Number two, this afternoon we're going to have a special edition of the Boomer the Babe Show. Deborah is actually going to be in studio, and she's going to be conducting an interview with a lady by the name of Kelly Ballardo. Kelly is an author, a speaker, self-esteem coach, and she has had a tremendous accident and deforming accident, and her book is entitled Self-Esteem Doesn't Come in a Bottle. So that will be a very interesting conversation, very interesting topic, and Deborah, as always, will do a wonderful job with that show. I'll be here as well, but that's going to be pretty much Deborah's baby because that's right in her wheelhouse with the items and ideas and things that involve women in particular. So we'll be glad to have Deborah here doing that show this afternoon at 2 o'clock Arizona time. And in addition to the radio program, we publish many books, ebooks, and we have ebook authors that have their shows on this Blog Talk radio station on the Boomer and the Babe Network. Earlier today, we had Ron Naraki with Wealth DNA. Coming up later this week, we're going to have Eileen Proctor with Fervently Speaking, all about pets. A couple of very good shows, a couple of very great knowledgeable people with regard to their topics of interest. So we encourage you to listen to them at all as well. And don't forget that amongst the ebooks and the mini books that we publish, we also do videos for people's websites, and we do small business consulting. So if you're in need of any of that or promotional products, we'd be more than happy to try to help you out in those areas. We are truly a multifaceted multimedia marketing company. You can contact us, of course, through our website, which is boomerandthebabe.com. That's boomerandthebabe.com. And I am Pete Peters. As I said, Deborah will be on her, doing basically her own show this afternoon, which will be fun. But today's guest is a very interesting lady and a very timely topic for any of us baby boomers. Her name is Carolyn A. Brent. And Carolyn is an author and a speaker, and she's author of the book Why Wait? The Baby Boomer's Guide to Preparing Emotionally, Financially, and Legally for a Parent's Death, which is a guide to family caregivers and aging parents alike. The release date is later next month, November 2011. And as a speaker of important, it's important to the adult siblings and the parents as well, to she calls have crucial I'm not speaking well, crucial conversations in preparation for the end of life issues that they face, so that instead of being torn apart, they can come together as a strong family. She is committed to enhancing the life of family caregivers and their aging parents throughout the world. A big undertaking, Carolyn A. Brent. Thank you very much for being a guest on the show. We appreciate you coming to visit with us today.
And thank you for having me. I'm really honored to be here.
Well, you've got a big, big chore ahead of you. There's only 78 million baby boomers, and every one of them probably, and one form or another probably for the most part, have a parent or have been through the trials and tribulations that you speak of. But before we get to that, why don't you just give us about a two-minute movie, if Deborah were here, she would say that two-minute movie, of your life prior to becoming Carolyn Brent, famous person. What was Carolyn Brent when Carolyn Brent was a younger person, shall we put it?
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, actually, I have a pharmaceutical background. I've been in the pharmaceuticals for 17 years. And what really got me interested in pharmaceuticals, I always wanted to, like, understand, you know, drugs and, you know, dying and living and, you know, health and beauty, all of that. Prior to the pharmaceutical industry, I was in the beauty industry for many years, working for some of the national places like Revlon. Everyone's heard of Revlon. And it just got me really interested in, you know, the aging process. And I'm going all the way back from like high school up, you know, how I could slow down the aging process, what I could do through eating right, et cetera. So, my beauty background, along with the pharmaceutical background, it was a really, really good match for what I thought I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And that was, at the time, I thought I was going to be in the pharmaceutical industry forever and retire in the industry. But some things happened in my life that clearly that's not what I was really called to do. I feel that God had given me that background in order to make me the person that I am today, as far as the health part, wanting to be healthy, and also knowing about medicine, and really, really fighting to just be healthy. It's an everyday battle to stay healthy, mentally and physically.
So I know some of your backstory and how you came to be involved in the writing of your book and so on. But is it safe to say that a lot of us, as I said earlier, 78 million of us all have parents or have had parents, and many of us have faced an issue with their parents. And I understand that you faced an issue with your father, and that was what was the catalyst to writing the book and a great deal of the work that you're doing. Just give us a thumbnail sketch of how that came to be, and what was it about your father's situation, and how did you get directly involved in it?
Well, great question. My father has always been a very, very health-minded person, both physically and mentally and emotionally. He was a pastor. He was very, very heavy into nutrition, and my father was truly my hero. I thought that Dad was going to live forever. I thought he was going to be healthy forever, because that's how Dad was for many, many, many years of his life. But as I grew a little bit older, and being a clinical education manager in the pharmaceutical industry, it enabled me the opportunity to fly back and forth to Colorado to visit Dad. And on my visits, I noticed that Dad was kind of slipping mentally, like he would forget to. One day he called me long distance and said, "Carolyn, I flooded my basement. I don't know what to do. Can you please help me?" Now, I was living in California. Dad was living in Colorado, but Dad was treating it as though that I could hop on an airplane, be at his house the next day to help him with simple stuff. And I thought, well, maybe Dad just missed me. That's why he wants me here. But I noticed my father actually needed me, because he did not know what to do. And one other time I visited my dad, my father had lost like 30 pounds, and I'm going like, how did Dad, how did you lose so much weight? My father was forgetting to eat. So I had taken my father to the Veterans Hospital, and that was when I was called by a doctor. You know, when he saw me, he said, oh, thank God you brought your dad here. His hemoglobins are so low, your father could have died. Thank God you are his caregiver. And I thought, I'm not my dad's caregiver. I'm my dad's daughter. I'm just visiting my dad. And, you know, dad is strong. He doesn't need a caregiver. And then I realized something wasn't right with my father. And I started doing more and more investigating and found out he was in the early stages of dementia. So that was when my daughter role slipped into a caregiving role. And that was back in 1997.
It's amazing, isn't it, Carolyn, how quickly that switch flips. I mean, it's like you walk into the room, you turn on the light, and you go, aha, my role has changed.
Absolutely.
And it will be changed forever from that point forward. You can still be the daughter. And
right.
You can still have the love and the caring as a daughter or
right.
as a son. But the role is changed. Now, you had brothers and sisters, correct?
Absolutely, I did, yes.
Now, how did it... Well, this is interesting because it kind of leads us into this whole topic. How was it that you were the one that became the caregiver when you had brothers and sisters? I'm going to guess. Now, I don't remember us having this conversation, but were they closer in proximity to your father than you were?
Absolutely. Four of them at the time, while alive, were closer. They were 200 miles away from our father. And then I was 1,500 miles away. But what made me the person elected to be, there was twofold. I was very, very close with my dad. We had a very close relationship. And also my siblings thought, oh, you don't have children. You're not married, so you could do it. You have the time. Not knowing, working in pharmaceuticals, I didn't have any extra time. My time was all traveling and working. But people just automatically think when you do not have children or if you're not married, you have all this extra time on your hands, which is not a true statement.
Well, I want this is interesting because the title of your book, The Baby Boomer's Guide to Preparing Emotionally, Financially, and Legally for a Parent's Death, that's sounds like a three-legged stool to me, and any one of which, if it's not being taken care of, could cause major, major issues. And then when you start putting things together, like you have some disparate relationships with people as far as who's expecting to do what, it could get really complicated, can it?
Absolutely. It gets very, very sticky, very, very complicated. I have learned, but it's taken research and it's taken me to go through the grieving process, and I still grieve, but I mindfully grieve now. And what I mean by mindfully grieving, anything that I know that's going to trigger depression or sadness, I totally stay away from it. I won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. So I mindfully grieve because I will always miss my father forever and ever. But this is what the deal is. If I, looking back and if I had to do it all over again, preparing emotionally, we all have to realize that we were born to die. That's the number one thing. If we were to have those early conversations early, such as I would say as early as 12 years old, if you're young enough to talk about sex, you're young enough to talk about death and dying. That's a key fact. The reason why kids are afraid, that grow up to adults, to be afraid to talk about death and dying, because our parents have put that in, a person. Like you go to a funeral, people are screaming and crying and there's sorrow. So nobody wants to be around it. Why do we have to go to a funeral and they're screaming, crying, and sorrow? One could guess and say, is it guilt that's making a person scream, sorrow, and sadness? Because when a person truly, if you're close to that person, yes, you're going to have sadness, but you're able to mindfully grieve and let go because you know the person is going to be in a better place, because we don't want our parents to be suffering with dementia, suffering with cancer or or anyone. I'm just any human being, period. So it's easier to let go if you have a plan and you could be with that person and the family could hone around that person with solace and as a team, and families could be a support to one another. That's the emotional part. And I've interviewed clinical psychologists, psychiatrists from around the U.S. in regards to this, and typically it's the acceptance part. And there's an excellent person that had written, it's the Kubler-Ross, it's called The Five Stages of Death or Grieving. And if a person can know those five stages, first there's denial. Many of us are in denial. Then there's anger. Then there's bargaining. Then there's depression. Then there's acceptance. It took me a long time to get to the acceptance stage, but I found out my siblings, all seven of them, we were all at different stages at a different time. So therefore, I understand now, looking back, they stayed in the denial stage. The dad was ever sick. That's the emotional part.
And it's imagined it's somewhat tough to do, to get everybody to go through those stages simultaneously. Is there a way that you found that you could facilitate that?
Actually, no. And because people grieve differently and the stages are different, I would definitely, if I had to do it all over again, knowing the information that I have, I would have gotten a third party involved with the health of my dad and also the health of the family. And what I mean by that, I would have gotten a mediator to talk about, okay, everybody got to pull together here and let's talk about, you know, the different stages where you're at. Now, mindfully, there are some adult siblings that don't want anything to do with the whole process. My siblings told me, you handle it. We don't care. We don't want to know. That's it. Now, that's where the legal part comes in. Had I known, I would have gotten, it's called a sibling contract. I never knew about a sibling contract until I started researching. And there's a woman by the name of Carolyn Rosenblatt. She is an attorney, a geriatric attorney slash mediator slash sibling rivalry attorney. I've never heard of a person like that until I researched it out. I interviewed her for my book, and I said, where were you, you know, 20 years ago? You know, where were you? Why is this law a brand-new law? Why don't people know about this? The law is only 5 years old. But that would have protected me at the end of what my siblings thought was my father's life. It would have protected me from someone dragging me through probate court or dragging me to court for any reason as far as harming. That would have protected me. So that's where the financial arm comes in. And so if the family refuses to get together and have these conversations, that's when it's time to put it in writing, where if Sally Mae doesn't want to get involved, Sally Mae needs to put that in writing so that when Sally Mae decides that I finally want to take over because mom or dad is dying, then it goes to court. The judge will see that this person clearly never took mom or dad to a doctor's appointment, never changed mom or dad's diaper, never got involved. They will see it's because they smell blood, which is like sharks. They're going after the money that they think is there.
Let me ask you this. Do you think there's I can understand how the monetary thing can happen. I've seen it happen in my family with relatives other than my immediate relatives. But I've seen it happen, and I know it happens. And it's selfishness and greed. That just goes without saying.
Absolutely.
But is there a point, maybe with immediate family, brothers and sisters, as relates to a parent, as an example, is there a point where maybe they're getting involved because all of a sudden they're realizing the end is nigh and they are now guilty for not having done it, feeling guilty for not having done anything?
You know what? That could be a reason, and that is a reason. Typically, guilt has a lot to do with it, but this is where, you know, I draw the line. get involved at the end, like with, you know, hospice or anything of that nature, but don't get involved by filing a restraining order against the long-standing good caregiver and falsified documentations because you want to take over. That is one of the reasons that really forced my arm to go to the state Senate and also go to our government. I went to our governor. I've gone to state senators. I've gone to Congress. Everybody knows me in all three legislations as far as what I stand for. Because what's happening right now, a person could take care of a parent for 27, 30 years. And a disgruntled sibling, as soon as they feel that that parent is dying, they can file false charges. And I'm speaking only about the good caregiver. I'm not speaking about if a person is a bad caregiver and they're abusing a senior. That's not who we're talking about here, so I really want to make that clear. But there was a lady that I interviewed. She cared for her mom for 27 years, and this is just last year this happened. And at the end of her mother's life, and the mother was 96 years old, her 66-year-old sister filed abuse charges against her 72-year-old sister, and the 72-year-old sister could not go near their mom that's 96 years old. As a direct result, the 66-year-old sister became instant temporary power of attorney. So that happened in my case too. It happened exactly in my case, but mine went a little bit further. Once my sibling went before the judge in one jurisdiction, she looked at the judge and said, "Oh, Your Honor, I dropped the charges." And I said, "Your Honor, you know, she's put this restraining order against me. They're all lies. I want to talk about it." And the judge said, "We cannot talk about that because this person dropped the charges." And as soon as I walked out of court, my niece that I thought was coming to give me a hug, which was my sibling's daughter, walked up. I thought she was going to hug me. She gave me another restraining order in another county with the same charges. That's when I said, this has to stop. There's people abusing the system because of greedy family members looking for money, looking for blood, and it has to stop. So I've been working for the past 4 years bringing this to the United States government, our government, to help change the laws to protect the senior that's put their things in writing and the caregiver that has given their life for caring for someone else. That is a very tough job to be a caregiver, and this is unpaid, okay? I never got one dime for my dad and would never want one dime for my dad, but I gave up. I went from age 40, I guess I was 44 years old, to 50-something years old. I don't remember, you know, anything in between. I just went from my early 40s to my early 50s overnight because of caring for my dad. That's with no pay, so people have to realize when you're caring for a sick adult and it's a family member, sometimes you have to give up your jobs. I gave up my six-figure income that I was earning as a clinical education manager, and I took a substantial pay cut so I could be a sales rep and not travel to take care of my dad. People don't look at that. They just look at, oh, you know, you're not freaking out. You look nice. You look healthy. You live in a nice house. You must be stealing money from the person that you're caring for. That's not the case. That is not the case in most instances.
Aside from families getting together and having this end-of-life conversation well in advance of the end of life, what can be done? I mean, I'll just interject what I know has been done with my situation. That is, my parents, God love them, they have done the family trust, they have done the will, they have done the medical care directive,
mm-hmm.
And they have all that down so that when the time came, when my father passed, the time came, the contact was made to the appropriate people, and they came and they took his remains and prepared him for his internment. and it was hands off, and there was no questioning. Now, my mother was still alive, but there's going to be no questioning when she goes, whenever that is, hopefully a long time from now. But nonetheless, my sister and I know exactly what's going on. We know what monies are already set aside for my sister.
Right.
We know what monies are already set aside for me.
Right.
And we know that what the disposal of the real property is going to be based on what she and I decide to do.
Right.
With the real property. But whatever it is, it's a 50-50 split.
Right.
Because it's the two of us. As far as any other personal belongings, that's also spelled out that she would like to have this granddaughter get that and that granddaughter get this and, you know, so on and so forth. So that really, at some juncture, I would imagine, is some responsibility of the parents prior to even thinking about the fact that they might be getting sick.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I like to say one thing. I tell parents this. If you don't make your decisions now, then you don't want a disgruntled adult sibling to make end-of-life choices for you later. That's what I say. So even the baby boomers, okay, baby boomers that were born between 1946 and 1964, they have children, adult children, many of the baby boomers. And they have to put their things in order because, once again, you have a very beautiful situation. But believe it or not, that's very, it's rare. It's more of the norm for people not to have things in order. There's only 55% of the U.S. population that have a will in place, and that's the total population. That's pretty sad. So that is why our probate courts are bulging at the seams. That's why families, they could fight for 1 year in probate court. I know of a lady that I interviewed. They fought for 17 years, and by the time, you know, things were dispersed between the family members, half the family had died, and then the little that they did receive, was it really worth tearing up the family for just for stuff that, I mean, I figured get a job, work hard, put your things in order, and don't depend on the family inheritance, if there is any. Another thing, people don't realize, medical care is very, very expensive. People are living longer, but not necessarily healthier. So one hospital stay could actually wipe out somebody's bank account. I don't care how much money they have. One hospital stay, depending on the surgery, depending on the need, depending on a lot of variables. Assisted living, it starts out at $32,000 a year. Now, that's when a person is healthy. If a person gets sick, that price goes up starting at $79,000 a year, and that's for, like, nursing care 24 hours a day. So a person has to really realize end of life is going to cost more to keep a person alive. So why should families fight? They should not fight at all.
Well, there's no. It's not, probably not the right term, but there's no future in it. There's nothing to be gained by it except hard feelings, conceivably hatred, and a long-standing family friendships and love can be completely torn asunder and dissolved and never to be spoken again.
Absolutely.
And that does nobody any good until one of those siblings dies, and then all the siblings will get back together again like locusts and try to pick the bones off of that estate.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's amazing how history has a tendency to repeat itself.
Absolutely. And I am so glad you brought that up because of what I had to go through with my dad, with the siblings, you know, running after something that did not exist. As a matter of fact, the family member that did what she did to my dad, she had to place my father on welfare when she found that it was Carolyn, me, the one that was digging into her 401ks and her, you know, my monthly income to subsidize dad's assisted living. The sibling thought it was free. She thought the state paid for assisted living. How crazy is that? So what I've done to really protect myself, because I am single, I do not have children, I have put together a trust that no one can refute or dispute or say, oh, that's my sister, I love her, she doesn't have children. So typically it would go to next of kin if I didn't have anything in writing. But I have everything in writing so that there's not going to be a fight, because they are discluded from anything if I were to pass away tomorrow. I've taken care of that. So parents should take the responsibility. Every parent knows their child, or adult child. And if you have an adult sibling, that adult child that is irresponsible, do you want them to be your medical and fiduciary person? The answer is no. You want to accept your child and love your adult child for where he or she is at, but select your caregiver, your fiduciary, your agent, based on qualifications. First of all, does that child love you? That's the first question. Who's responsible? Is that person responsible? And you may have to reach out to an extended family member, or reach out to, you know, a healthcare person. You know, reach out to, you know, a director at a hospital. Reach out to someone that can be the fiduciary that, and a fiduciary, I like for people to know, is someone that takes an oath that will literally protect all of your assets, that money, monetarial assets. That is who you want to choose, someone that you could trust with your life. That's key.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say those things, because as I have alluded to, I am very fortunate.
Yes, you are.
In that all of the decisions have been made, and all I have to do, and all I did do as regards to my father when, as he was in the dying process, and in the hospitals and in the care facilities and so on, is I took a copy of his medical directives,
mm-hmm.
and the DNR, and what he wanted to have done, and what he was willing to have done to him in his behalf, and where the line was drawn as far as when do we stop offering anything other than comfort and pain relief.
Right.
That was all spelled out. It was black and white. And I go, here's a copy for you, administrative
yes.
people at the hospital. Here's a copy for you, administrative people at the skilled nursing center. And here's a copy for you, hospice. And they all knew it. There was no doubt about it, and it was handled to a T, and the only thing I had to do, and matter of fact, I didn't have to do this. I went the night he passed, the people at the hospice, they called the mortuary and had the mortuary come and take his remains. I didn't do a thing other than spend some time with him at his bedside with my mother. That was it.
Right.
And when we left, we went home, knowing that later that in a matter of a few hours, because it was very early in the morning, in a matter of a few hours, that we were going to go to the mortuary and we were going to make whatever final arrangements. How many death certificates do we want, or do we feel we need? What's going to be the final arrangements? Are there going to be any extras? Because everything was prepaid.
Right.
The tournament was prepaid.
Wow, so that's beautiful.
It was absolutely phenomenal.
Yes.
And his last 9 days, my mother as well, but I got to spend 9 days with that man as he peacefully rested in a hospice.
That is so beautiful.
It is. And I cannot for the life of me, see why other people don't understand that and can't see that it can be like that. They just don't, maybe they just don't want to face the fact that, you know, they're put on this earth to die.
Right, right.
You know, and if it had been a sudden accident, sudden death, car accident, a fall off of a building, or you know, whatever the heck it would be, the outcome is still the same.
Absolutely.
And the fact is, if you don't have something in place, there's a lot of people that are going to be toast. It doesn't matter to you anymore.
Absolutely. That's it. You know, that is what I am like screaming around the country. And what I mean screaming, I'm just simply saying I put the word out there every day on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. I'm sharing with people, why wait? Get your things in order now. I have a friend, Paul, 52 years old. She kind of disappeared for like several months, and I kept, you know, calling her home. And finally, her son contacted me and said, my mom is in hospice. She may have only 2 weeks, and she's 52 years old. Now, one would think, they think dying, death and dying, is for the elderly, old people in the nursing homes. It could happen to anybody. Anybody could have any disease to happen sudden and unexpectedly. And that's why it is so imperative. There's something that's called the five wishes that that a person should have, you know, to give to the family members in dying. And one is to, you know, who's going to make the decisions for you, the medical decisions? What kind of medical treatments do you want? How comfortable do you want to be? Do you want to be on life support? Do you not want to be on life support? How do you want people to treat you? And lastly, you know, what do you want your loved ones to know about you? And that is one of the reasons my father has been an inspiration to me, because he was a pastor. He believed in helping the needy, helping the sick, helping the poor. And my father would never have wanted his own adult children to disgrace his legacy. So what I am doing, my father's legacy of good is coming through me. So that's why I didn't take my siblings to court for defamation of character. For what purpose would that serve? So I decided to do good with this horrible journey that I was chosen. I believe I've been chosen to go on this journey to do something good to help others. And that is what my father would have wanted me to do, and that is the legacy and his last wishes that he would have wanted to do good. So that's something that people need to think about. And they could Google five wishes. It's a site called Aging with Dignity. So we all want to die with the respect and dignity. And that's what we, as adult siblings, and I'm speaking of the baby boomers because that's where I focus my target on, we should hone together as one unit. And I, Paul, I give you and your sister so much credit, because that is the best-case scenario. And I talk about the best-case scenario when families work together, and I also talk about the worst-case scenario, like mine. But there's cases worse than mine where families kill each other. I mean, literally kill each other for, you know, for when someone's died on their deathbed. And that just should not be. It's called greed. It boils down to greed. And one thing that I've learned through this process that I've been on and through my research, greed has no boundaries. I've been on a radio show in Spain. They're having the same problem there. I've been on two London shows, and they've had the same issues with the greed factor. So we are throwing our elderly away with the hopes of the greed factor coming in and taking what we think is ours. That has to stop.
Well, there's that runs rampant, no matter what nationality, no matter what country, you know, what belief structure, it always seems to creep its way in. Let's talk a little bit about families themselves and some end of life issues. I'm going through this list of things that you cover with people, and my question is, one of my questions amongst many others is, when would I, as an adult sibling, or myself and my brothers and sisters, not when, but how do we go about broaching that subject with our parents that don't have a death or dying situation handled, but we know that they should? How do we go about handling that?
That is a great question, and I always recommend Do not bring it up at the family dinner table for Christmas and Thanksgiving. Just celebrate those days for what they're worth. But,
Merry Christmas, Mom and Dad. Look at the time. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. So those are the two dates that I would recommend not to bring it up. But if there has to be somebody in the family that is very mature, that really understands the fact of life, that is the sibling, like such in my case, I would bring it up to my siblings, and they never wanted to hear it. I mean, so you do have the case scenarios where you could bring it up over and over and over. I even created a 5-inch binder with all medical records, financial records. They said they didn't even want to see that. So, but I think the sooner the better. Just bring it up to the parents. Let the parents know we need to get together as a family. Mom and Dad, we need to get together as a family because we're not going to live forever. And, you know, do you want, you know, someone to make decisions for you when you could make decisions on your own? And, you know, the siblings, the adult siblings, need to be mature enough to not think that the mom or dad are playing favoritism if they ask someone in the family to be the, someone has to be in charge. So if everybody could get together, you know, from an emotional standpoint and, you know, point out who's the most qualified in certain areas, if that's the case, or get a mediator involved, which that's going to cost money, but in some cases, maybe a mediator could help with this, but the sooner the better. And if I tell the parents, you know, especially the adult baby boomers with the traditionalist parents that are still alive, put the things in order, mom and dad, you know, but typically the traditionalists, and these are people over the age of 66. Those are our traditionalists. Many of them are in the early stages of dementia. They don't even want to talk about death and dying because they feel like their kids are going to rob them. I mean, I've seen some of everything, but it's very important to have medical intervention and legal intervention if there is a foreseeable issue or problem.
Well, this I'll mention this because it's pretty much the way it was handled as far as my parents were concerned. Years ago, and I mean years ago already, when my dad was very much alive and very much with it, they put together the family trust. And it was a copy for them, each of them, a copy for me, and a copy for my sister. And they were given to us and said, this is what we want done if we were to die or get sick. And that was it.
Right.
There was no discussion. In this
right.
particular instance, they gave it to us. This is our last, this is our final, these will be our final directives, and we expect you to have make sure that this is done the way, excuse me, the way we have written.
Right.
And, you know, so it was written, so it shall be type of a thing.
Right.
And we go, fine. And I got my copy, and frankly, I didn't look at it. I put it away.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew exactly where it was, and when the time came, and if the time came prematurely, I could take that thing out, and I could go bang, 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 bang. This is what we're going to do.
Absolutely.
So I had no interest in knowing. I didn't care for the most part. At some point, I may have looked at it and said, well, you know, what do they want to do as far as care, whatever, you know, whatever the case might be.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it, and I just accepted it for what it was because it was their thing, and it's what they wanted to have done, and it was the way they wished it to be handled. So
absolutely.
It was great. I mean, it was absolutely great. And the only thing I have to worry about now with my mother is where did she put her DNR? She doesn't remember.
Right.
Yeah. But nonetheless, there is a DNR as part of that with regard to care in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
but there's not a DNR as regards if she were to have a fall or a stroke or something like that at home.
Right.
So I've got to get that handled. We were talking about that just yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Right.
Where'd you put the DNR, Mother? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But nonetheless, the fact is, that a lot of times I think, tell me if this is right or wrong, I think when the kids come to the parents get defensive And even if they're doing it at a younger age, the parents get defensive and say, what are you, just interested in getting my money?
Yeah, that happens quite often.
And that's where you need to have that mediator.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That happens quite often because the parents, think about this, many Americans say, well, if something happens to me or if I die, then this is what I would like. And they're using that word if like we have options. So it's the matter of when. If they could turn that if into a when, and it's the parents' responsibility, and that's why I wrote the book, get the paperwork in order in both in the federal, the state, and also county. My father had his paperwork in order only in federal court because we did not know, Paul, to have it in county and also state. Who was to think that a sibling, a disgruntled sibling, would go through a different jurisdiction to overrule something that a parent put in place? That's where the gray area of law that I'm trying to get that gap closed. But the bottom line is parents have to take the responsibility. Another thing that I love what you talked about, how your dad and your mom put everything in place and they gave you the envelope. I interviewed a woman. There's three siblings, and her parents did the same exact thing, put everything in writing. All three of the siblings had their pouches of the trust in place. But one of the siblings decided that she wanted to open to see what mom and dad had, you know, put in place. And she explained to me how the sister was outraged because dad was giving this fabulous, you know, Rolex watch to one of the siblings' spouses, and the sibling that opened up the pouch said, well, my husband deserves that Rolex. I mean, it's just it can be a big mess. So I think the parents should also say, here's the information. Do not open it until something happens to me and, you know, I'm on my deathbed or it's an unexpected emergency, then you open it. But it caused family feud while the parents were still healthy about where was this watch going to go. Do you know what I'm saying? So it all boils down to stuff, and it makes me sick that people fight over stuff.
Well, it is. It's a shame, and I think that's the human condition nowadays. Everybody just wants stuff.
Yeah.
Regardless of what value may or may not be, they want to have stuff. They want to accumulate stuff, and it's a sad state of affairs. Get back this to some of these other points with regard to families and end of life issues. You had a situation that you mentioned that your caregivers were closer than you were, but let's just turn that around a little bit. Let's say that you were the one that was closest and your caregiving or your siblings were scattered all over. Your dad was in Colorado.
Yes.
And somebody in New York and somebody in Georgia and somebody in San Diego. How do you get all of those people involved in the situation, although they're so far away?
That's a great question. And nowadays it's so much easier because you can communicate with Skype, which is free, communicate on, you know, teleconference.com, which is free. There's different free, there's internet, you know, free, all this free, you know, communication. Whereas when I was caring for my dad, it was the long distance phone calls that cost money and the whole bit. But the way I tried to get all my siblings that were scattered around, I would just ask, can we all take a turn? Just 1 week out of the year, you come, and I even offered to pay for round-trip tickets, pay their time off work, just come and give me a break, the caregiver, and then you could do more bonding with dad. So those are like options. I do believe caregiving is a family affair, and it's crucial if there's, you know, more than one sibling that the siblings pitch in, if you have a vacation, donate your vacation time and go take care of mom and dad. Or if mom and dad are still in good physical condition to travel, let them go and stay in your home for a week or two. Another thing that siblings that are around the country, for them to see and, you know, really kind of walk in the path of a sibling that is the caregiver, I challenge Americans to volunteer in either a hospice for 1 hour, or be in a nursing home for a couple of hours, or be in assisted living all day long. Volunteer in one of those places. Now, this is what it's going to do when you go into one of these places. It's going to give you a bird's eye view of what it's like to be a caregiver, because all three areas are different. The assisted living, the seniors are typically healthy, and they just need someone to remind them to give them their medications and food, and they're really active people. So the assisted living, it's a healthier way of living. Then you have the 24-hour nursing homes. You'll have people sitting in chairs, kind of staring out into ozone. A lot of these nursing homes, I call them, excuse the expression, pee-pee joints. You walk in, and the smell of urine will slap you in your face. And I don't care how expensive the place is, many of them will have that, you know, that odor in the air, because you're dealing with maybe, 30 to maybe 50 people in diapers, adults in diapers at the same time, and maybe their diapers are not being changed as often. Walk in there, volunteer your time. Some people walk through the door and turn straight back around and go, I can't handle this. Oh, I don't want to be a part of this. Then you go to a hospice where people are truly, literally, they're given 6 months or less to live. Or if they're in a hospice facility, and some people will bring their hospice parents home with them, volunteer and see what it's like. If everybody volunteered one moment, just 10 minutes of their time, if they can handle 10 minutes or a full day, then that will give a person a different perspective of what it's like to be a caregiver, and support that caregiver family. Don't beat that caregiver up when that caregiver has given his or her life, including their income, including their emotional, because I know for a fact I am not the same person. After caring for my dad and being the sole one and going through looking for dad when dad got lost and getting the emergency telephone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning, your dad has had, a massive this or a massive that, get to the hospital. The one that took my dad to what I thought was a routine doctor's visit to find out, the doctor gave me two choices. He said, your daddy's going to die within 24 hours if you don't have his tubing, which was a shunt, pull from his head, because your dad's having a massive hematoma, which is bleeding. If you don't pull that tube, your dad's going to die. Or we could pull the tube, your dad's going to be a vegetable. Which would you prefer? Oh, my God, to be faced with a decision like that, it's not a pretty sight. So to attack a caregiver that has given his or her life to because of love, I know that I used to have talks with God, and I would say, dear God, I give my life for my dad. I put my dad in front of me. And that was how I survived. I was having my little, minute-by-minute talk with God, because it was such an overwhelming experience, and I felt that I was alone. And I was the type of caregiver, I did not like going to caregiver support groups. And the reason why I didn't like going, because it was too depressing for me. Everyone was crying about, oh, my parent is going through this and woe is me. I was already feeling bad. I didn't want to be in that environment. So that is why I created caregiverstory.com resources to find answers, to be with powerful people that could give you solutions instead of talking about the problem. That is why I created that website.
Tell us a little bit more about that website. What's on that website?
Anything and everything that a person needs, family members, doctors, lawyers, family supports, you know, mediators, anything that you think that you would need to help your parent, government programs. For an example, I've worked in pharmaceuticals for 17 years, and I put on my website, if your parents cannot afford their $500 a month medication, there is a program called Patient Assistant Program that most people don't know about. Because when you're 80 years old and your one of your prescriptions, $500 per prescription, how can you afford that? There's patient assistant programs with all major pharmaceutical companies if you meet a certain income. So, you know, I expose different rich resources for people because our parents are living longer, not necessarily healthier, and should they live at my next-door neighbor, her mom is 102 years old. The medical cost for her mom to stay on this planet is it's enormous. I think it's $290 per day that my friend is paying for her mom to, you know, have medical care. That's a lot of money to come out of pocket with. So, you know, my website is designed to find solutions to this, the growing problem that we have as baby boomers, and to prepare.
We're coming down to the short rows here as far as this program's concerned, Carolyn. Why don't let me ask you one more question, and then we'll kind of start to wrap things up a little bit here. What is the difference between a medical power of attorney and a directive?
Oh, very excellent question. The directive is who you want for to like call the shots, and it can be a dualship. The directive could be, let's say my father could say, I give the directive to the healthcare provider at Sutter Goal, and the medical power of attorney, who's going to make the medical decisions, like what your wishes are going to be to get, like what you have for your mother right now. You have the medical directive as far as taking your mom to the hospital, and you know, you could have both. In other words, it's one of the same, but two different people could have it, if that makes sense.
So you can split the duties, basically.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So absolutely.
The medical directive is written down, and the person's saying, this is what I want to have done in given these circumstances.
Absolutely.
I don't give me nothing except comfort care, and no need to tube feed me, no need to put me on a respirator, that's a medical directive.
Absolutely.
So
and my father, oh, go on.
That the power of attorney is the person that can take care of all of the other ancillary things that are going on with regard to personal things, with regard to how bills get paid, who writes checks, and so on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the medical directive is more powerful than the power of attorney. I had found, well, for an example, my daddy had a power of attorney, and we also had a medical directive. The medical directive was with the federal agency. I lost the paperwork. I didn't put the paperwork in a comfy little area where I could get my hands on it. I lost it. So I had the power of attorney, and the hospital would not or questioned it because the family member said, oh, that's false. That was it was forged. These papers are forged. That's what the family member did, and it took the federal government 1.5 years to send the medical directive that my father had signed to show that I truly had the power to make medical decisions for my dad.
And under certain circumstances, he could already have passed away by the time you got those back.
Absolutely. So now, looking back in retrospect, I tell people, put your paperwork in a vault. It could be in a vault at a bank or a vault at your home, someplace where you can get your hands on it, and by all means, let someone else know where that paperwork is. That was the valuable lesson I learned because of what I had gone through. Oh, my God, life-changing event for me.
Well, why don't we wrap this up, Carolyn, by having you tell us how people can get hold of you. Give us all your websites where all your good information is, and we'll make sure that we have all that on the archive that way, so when people listen to this program in the future, they'll have all that good stuff.
Okay, well, first, caregiverstory.com. That's a very easy site to, you know, remember. Just think of Caregiver Story, and it's a very rich content website. Then there's babyboomersguide.org. That's another, it's a blog, but it's very rich content blog. And also on that babyboomersguide.org, I'm offering an international free telesummit November 8th, 9th, and 10th. And the experts from all three fields, I'm having psychiatrists, psychologists, elder law attorneys, everyone specialized in elder law and also legislation, on each day to speak about these same issues, and it's totally free to the public that I have put together as another rich resource. Then you have my book at Amazon.com, and it's available now, but my book is going to be officially launched November 15th, and that's when, you know, it really counts for me as far as how many books are sold that particular day, because I'm trying to get some laws changed. So when legislation see that people really want to know, that can help speed up the process that has taken me now 4 years of beating on the doors of Congress, state, and also to change legislation for to protect our seniors, our veterans, and, of course, the caregiver.
Well, Carolyn, it's all good information. It's timely information. It'll always be timely, regardless of whether, frankly, you're giving it or generations from now are giving it. But it's all good to have you doing this now, and I appreciate all your good work. I'm going to get in contact with you here right shortly after this show. I want to mention another possibility for you, but I won't take the time to do it here on the air.
Okay.
So other than that, thanks again for being a guest on the show. It's been an emotional conversation, but a good conversation, and I'm glad you were here to share your information with us.
And thank you for sharing. I really enjoy it.
We did enjoy it as well. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today we had an excellent conversation with Ms. Carolyn A. Brent discussing dying and dying directives and pre-planning and all that is necessary and the tremendous need for it. And if you want to have any further contacts with Carolyn, you can get them here on the information on the archive that will be going up shortly after this show. Listen to the Boomer the Babe Show every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio. Don't forget a special edition of the Boomer the Babe Show with Deborah Brown this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Deborah's in the studio. Hey, what do you think of this, folks? She's actually going to come back and do some radio with us. Remember, we do much more than host this radio show on Blog Talk. Check us out at www.boomerandthebabe.com. That's boomerandthebabe.com. See everything that makes up the Boomer and the Babe Incorporated. Be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and come back and listen to us at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Have a great afternoon, everybody.
Show where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.